If you are only thinking about like writing emails faster or writing SQL queries faster, you still write the email and you still write the SQL query. Maybe there's a world in which you shouldn't be writing that email in the first place. If you are just making horses move faster, you're gonna miss cars.
If you aren't already using AI agents, you are officially behind. Fortunately, you're in the right place. Today on AI in Action, you are going to hear about how and why the agentic AI workflow can and will augment your business from one of the leading voices in the industry. We are so grateful to be joined today by Ali K. Miller, CEO of OpenMachine and Fortune 500 AI Advisor. Ali, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I'm going to get right into it. How are AI agents reshaping the way people fundamentally think about work?
I think one thing that's just important to call out is that AI agents do stuff. A lot of people are used to using ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini or whatever. That is a very knowledge-based interaction. Even with hallucinations, it's still a very like knowledge and intelligence-based interaction. AI agents are meant to do things, to actually accomplish tasks. And so that movement, that shift from actually AI being able to accomplish things on our behalf and not just write an email is a massive shift in how people are going to be able to use it inside of their work, regardless of what department they're in.
The first time I actually got my hands on like an agentic, like a framework.
Yeah.
And seeing the ability, like, cause like you said, like you could talk to any LLM and you're like, this is incredible. It's actually just like talking to a person. But as an engineer, I wanted to do stuff and tooling, like having tooling. I wanted to call a function. I wanted to be able to call a database if I need to get information to like really ground the responses. And so that from the ground level, unbelievable.
Yeah. We've had tool access for a bit, like even ChatGPT plugins, which were a failure. That was at the start of it.
Yeah.
And then we started to see GPT with function calls, and that was kind of the next. I think we've had to actually wait those 2.5 years of like the Gen AI revolution to actually get to agents. We couldn't have had them 2 years ago because the model quality literally wasn't high enough to be able to do things like deep reasoning or any sort of deterministic set.
So when you're talking to teams about AI agents and you're like telling them what the benefit of it is, how do you differentiate AI agents from conversational AI, from standard machine learning? Like what is the way that you articulate it? Is it just like do things?
That is definitely the umbrella statement. I also, whenever I'm educating folks, whether it's a CEO of a Fortune 500 company or a marketing manager at a startup, I am always thinking about how to make that education as easy as possible. The easiest way of explaining AI agents is that it is a thing that does stuff. At its core, it is doing stuff. It is a goal-based AI system with self-determined steps that goes through, that has access to tools, that hopefully has access to memory, that is able to accomplish tasks on your behalf. That's what it is. When I'm describing the value to someone, I'm not going to include any of that. That is like way too technical. I'm not going to break down the 6 components of an AI agent. It just falls on complete deaf ears. The way that I talk is that I cater it to whoever that person is. So if the person is a CEO, I'm going to shape it in terms of generating shareholder value or helping them execute on their vision or consistency across the company a lot more. If I'm talking to managers, I'm actually going to be talking about, hey, your workforce is changing and now you're going to be managing humans and AI agents. And you might be managing thousands of AI agents. And if it's an individual employee, I might be talking about, hey, the work that you are getting done as an IC, here's how your work is going to get shaped in the future. But so many executive teams are kind of forgetting that you have to cater that messaging to each group. And they're giving this very high-level view of AI agents to their company. And honestly, a lot of people at these companies are just getting terrified because they go, well, that's going to take my job.
You think there's a future, or is this future even exists? I don't know. But like where a manager has of employees and then also, well, then they got this AI agent that they also-
100%. Yeah. And even, I mean, the AI agent that you were talking about earlier, what did you build?
I don't know, a million different things. But like one of them was to find the correct data to ground just a natural language query.
Okay, perfect. Imagine that you're a data engineer and that normally the process of uncovering that one data point that you might want to bake into the back of a RAG system or whatever would take you, I don't know, hours probably to be able to find it, to be able to think about how to actually set it up. The fact that you now have an AI agent that is dedicated to a data engineering workflow, you might actually have 5 AI agents that are dedicated to a data engineering workflow. You as a data engineer have now become this master of 5 AI agents working on your behalf. And that's only for your core job. You might have a bunch of other AI agents that are helping on sales or finance or HR or legal. And so you as an individual might be interacting with and potentially even managing tens or hundreds of agents. The way bigger question is actually not whether someone's going to be managing AI agents, because I'm pretty set on that one. It's whether someone has to deal with the hundreds or whether they just get to deal with like an abstracted, you know, agent
supervisor,
at the top.
Yeah, like a supervisor agent.
And I just like kind of call it like the master brain because it's easy to think about sci-fi and think about that level. Maybe you only interact with like one or a couple of these master brains that kind of function as department heads and that you don't have to actually deal with all these sub agents. One example tool here that I don't think is a great tool, but it's a great way of learning about multi-agent workflows is called Proxy by Convergence. You ask it one question. It's a horizontal AI agent. You ask it one question and it actually spins up multiple AI agents to be able to get the work done. So you ask it one master question, it spins up a master agent. It might then spin up 3 to 5 mini agents that then come back and aggregate and be able to surface whatever that actual output is.
When you say spin up, you mean like spin up existing agents or spin up like how deep are we going here?
Listen, it might be that they are in existence. It might be that they are generated and created in real time. It really depends on what the orchestration layer is beneath that. I think a lot of companies are trying to build up this like platform of the stars and platform of the like AI agent generation. And whether you are going to be explicit about the type of agent you want to set up, you know, I always go from first principles. First principle is people don't want to figure out which 100 agents to spin up. So these systems are going to spin up their own. I have to imagine that some are going to be predetermined, which we already see now. You're also going to have to create some in real time, right? A lot of the rise of agentic AI, the reason that it's so exciting that AI can actually code at such a high level, that the SWEBench benchmark is doing so well, is not necessarily because of people like you, right? People like you can code. You're going to become a 10x engineer. It's going to be great. I can't wait to see your career thrive.
Thank you.
There are 5 billion internet users, and the majority of them are not developers. There's 28 million developers, 5 billion internet users. I am so excited for the 5 billion minus 28 million to get their hands on tools that are under the surface, actually doing some coding in real time to be able to build solutions in real time.
Like you said, you could have agents that are doing a million different things, but if you want to narrow it down for like these tech leaders, like we want to implement agentic AI in your current company's workflow, what are you going to focus on?
So a lot of the agentic AI workflows that work now actually have to be in a narrow world. It is narrow is best right now. We are not yet at the performance level. And maybe this will change, you know, the day after we record this podcast. Okay. But for now, horizontal is not where you're seeing that performance. So I would actually very heavily advocate for business leaders to start with those narrow views. And by the way, we saw the same thing 2.5 years ago with like the big Gen AI revolution. A lot of these early use cases were in line of business use cases. They were narrow. We saw them in customer support, the ability to have a human agent be supplemented by this little AI bot on the side that has access to hundreds of thousands of pages so that they become a supercharged customer support agent. We saw sales use cases where people were using AI to improve data hygiene, where they would get on a call, AI would transcribe the call and immediately update their CRM with like cleaned, you know, information about that client. We have seen line of business, vertical task specific things pretty much always succeed first. Horizontal requires a lot more creativity, a lot higher performance, a lot more orchestration. And so naturally it's going to come after. So right now we are in the early vertical AI agent space, and that's where you should start.
Is that like the main gist of that is it's a reliable use case that you can reliably get the correct responses from?
It's definitely part of it. I mean, reliability across all these things is still rough. And so maybe it's reliability plus the ability to benchmark and measure value. And that does relate to reliability. I also think cost is a big thing. And then there's this other third part that's maybe a little loftier to think through, which is the average person, the average employee who is not like you and me buried in AI agents every single day, they might not know how to use these tools. And so as they are using horizontal, broad-based AI agent platforms, they might be experimenting too wide or experimenting not deep enough or whatever. And so that might actually incur much more cost than a business is willing to get hit with. And so by starting with vertical or task specific, you're actually also operating at greater financial efficiency. And then maybe when horizontal AI agents get to that performance level, the average company, again, I'm not talking about the Fortune 50, but the average company is then going to be able to move into that horizontal AI agent space.
As an engineer and as my coworkers are engineers, a lot of the stuff we use are very individual. Like, it's very specific to me. It helps my productivity. But is that a mistake? Is that short-sighted for like leadership to look at individual productivity rather than something like team-wide productivity?
Is your happiness entirely determined by your productivity?
No, my wife. I have a kid.
In the workspace. I should have been more specific. But that's good that your wife is also making you happy. That's actually part of the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I am tied to my productivity. I feel accomplished when I am able to get stuff done. And if I'm more productive, I have a larger portion of time that I could do things that may not be directly what I had to have gotten done, but something I want to research, something I want to do that's out of the box. So I do like productivity.
Okay. But productivity, you like it because it gives you more time to reallocate to things that you
exactly
love.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
What I think a lot of businesses are getting wrong is that they believe that productivity is the end goal. A lot of businesses, if I'm an executive, if I'm an internal senior leader, right, director and above, I am thinking about output-based things. I am thinking about how many deals we can close. I am thinking about how much revenue we can get per customer or whichever, right? I am going to be very output-based. Too many companies have that as the end goal, and they're not thinking about that reallocation. They're not thinking about actual business line transformation. And so I for the last, probably year with my clients, I've been talking about how productivity is a trap. I've been forcing them to think outside of productivity for the beginning. It might be employee morale, which eventually has impact on like HR productivity because you don't have to hire as many people because churn is reduced, right? Employee churn. So that is definitely one. But the second is if you are only focused on productivity, if you're only focused on individuals being able to code things faster, you are going to miss the much bigger shift that's happening in business, which is the ability to generate completely net new business lines. And so one example that I, throw out, imagine that you are a media and entertainment group and you are making TV shows and movies all the time. Maybe you're even making podcasts, who knows? And so if you are thinking about a productivity lens, right, what might you be thinking? You might be thinking about how do we set up the set faster? How do we, get the audio editing to be faster? How do we book guests faster? You're going to be thinking about a productivity lens. What you are then going to miss and what will fly by you at 110 miles an hour and what your competitors are thinking about is how should you actually reinvent that process and that business from a foundation level? And so maybe in the next 10 years, the way that we actually create content or the type of content that we create should completely change. And if you've only thought about your business or your work or your workflows through a productivity lens, you will miss this much bigger transformation. And so a lot of people are on this like 35 mile an hour street thinking about productivity when actually what they should do is get the hell out of that car and actually look at what's happening next to them on the freeway, which is that business model shift. You can see it in startups. You can see it in Silicon Valley. You can see it in some regions more than others. The US is definitely ahead. But if you are not paying attention, you will miss it.
Something I wanted to ask you also is how do you identify these deadweight tasks? Which is, I guess, foundational to reorganizing the way that you do your business. So instead of just doing things quicker, like I could do, code a Python app quicker, how do I identify the tasks that I'm doing that are just totally irrelevant?
Can I tell you about a tool that I built?
Yes.
Okay. So I, too, was trapped in that question of like, for the last 2.5 years, I've told people a pretty normal response, which is write down all the tasks that you're doing. Like for 2 weeks, track down every single thing that you're doing. Keep a little sheet of paper on the side as you write down tasks. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, take a look at those tasks, kind of couple them and group them, and then try and assign AI to help you with some of those tasks. So the tool that I built, which I showed to my clients and anyone listening, by the way, can build their own, is you type in your job title and the company that you work for, and it goes through 10 steps. I'll give you the abbreviated version. Don't worry, we're not going to turn this into a podcast about the tool. First is it lists out your potential job description. Then it lists out what it guesses your tasks are. You can then eliminate or add. Then it guesses who you most likely collaborate with and then expands their tasks. Then it looks at those tasks, categorizes them by what can AI do today, what is AI likely to do with the next model release, and what is AI like nowhere near touching, what things feel very human only, like building relationships or something. Then it looks at what AI agents can help you with. Then it looks at your role being helped with AI agents. Anyways, by the end of it, it tells you which job you will likely have in the next coming years, what tasks you will likely be taking on, and what an AI agent or an AI system in general is taking advantage of. So long way of saying, right, TLDR, ask AI, give it your job, give it what you think your tasks are, have a back and forth conversation saying, you know, I'm worried about AI taking my job. I don't understand AI. Tell me about what AI agents could do in my type of role. How should I be thinking about AI evolution for my role? What sort of things should I be upskilling on now so that I have a career in 2 years? Those sorts of things you can ask an AI system or people in your field to be thinking through. But I literally built an AI tool so I could answer this at scale.
So there is an undercurrent of fear that you kind of touched on about people being like, okay, this can now do things. How do you describe not do things? What did you say?
I was even going to say it's not an undercurrent. It's like a tidal wave that's about to come up.
It but is, yeah. But people...
No,
are,
do things is, again, the very overly simplistic way of describing AI agents.
So you have this fear then. And then you also mentioned like, okay, productivity, is it necessarily tied to my happiness? Because you have a happy workforce, you're going to see those benefits. You know, that's going to be a knock-on effect later on to your shareholders. So what do you say to people like that? Like who are looking at this being like, wow, these could write SQL queries for me. And that's my whole job. I'm just writing SQL queries. This could do it for me in natural language. Like, what do you say to these people?
Here's how I would be thinking about fear. So first, the lens that conversation topic comes up when I'm talking to C-suite of Fortune 500 companies, where they're running a company of, say, 40,000 people, and they're thinking about how to more deeply embed AI into their workforce and how to get more people to use it and how to hit amazing efficiency, right? And then they come to me and then they go, hey, Ali, we have this amazing tool. We got every single person access to Watson X, Copilot, whichever. And we gave it to every single person in our company. 5% of people are using it.
Yeah.
Now what? And I'm like, because that's not how AI transformation works. And so I ask them, why do you believe people aren't adopting it? To which they usually say, I don't know. There are three key reasons. And fear is one of the biggest. Reason number one, I don't have time to test these things. I'm too busy. My work is too crazy, right? Too busy is definitely number one. And that's an excuse for everything. Number two is I don't know how this thing works. No one's taught me this thing. It looks like a blank page. It looks like Google. What can this thing actually do? And number three is I'm not going to train a system that's going to take over my job. Why would I do this? And so I think if these CEOs actually talk to their employees, they would probably figure out that like 80%+ of their employees are terrified of AI taking over the jobs. And I mean, again, at an average company, there are going to be some tech companies that are way more pro AI. There are going to be certain departments that are much more pro AI. Every single study, including I think one from IBM that I was looking at, sales, product, marketing, and engineering. Those are the four that are always going to be pro AI. As you figure out why people are not actually using these AI systems, you are going to come across the finding that every single business has found, which is people are scared. If you approach it as, don't be scared, just use it, and then you walk away as an executive and you fly to Hawaii and go on this nice vacation, adoption won't change and you're probably planting seeds for like mutiny, right? So to prevent this revolt, you actually have to address that fear. You as a executive have to stand up at your next all hands or whoever's leading your AI work. You have to stand up and you have to say, I know you are scared. I've talked to 20 of you. I've had surveys go out. I've read studies. I've been in these meetings where it gets brought up or whatever. I'm acknowledging that. Here is how we're going to address it as a company. Here is what role AI is and is not going to take. Here's the type of policy that we're going to have. Here's tools that we are going to use and which ones we're not. You have to be vocal and upfront about that role because too many business leaders are taking this approach of like, if we just scoot this fear under, you know, sweep it under the table, we're going to be fine. You know, people will eventually use it. Let's just force them to use it, right? Let's measure their success based on whether they use it or not and just force them into it. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It didn't work with cloud, didn't work with analytics. Not every single person figured out how to write SQL queries. We have to be at a stage where people are actually having those conversations, even if it feels difficult in the moment, even if it feels like this weird humanity level conversation that you have not been forced to have. You have to have it.
You've spoken to C-suites. Have they been like receptive to hearing this?
You know, C-suite folks love to be right. And when they're in a group, they are very vocal about, oh no, we've been doing this. Oh yeah, we're totally ahead. Yeah, we've been talking about that for 2.5 years, whatever. You know what happens? I get them into a one-on-one conversation and I'm meeting with the CEO, CFO, CTO, CIO, whichever. And I talk to them and I go, what do you really think? Every single one of them, okay? 2 minutes later, they go, I am terrified.
Really?
I think I'm gonna lose my job. Yes! There was a study that just came out, I think it was from Fortune, that said 79% of CEOs are worried that because they handle AI wrong, they will lose their job in the next 2 years. That is a real stat.
That's unbelievable.
And so these CEOs, they're very worried about making the wrong move because, number one, the economy is so volatile that any sort of thing in the wrong direction could just be a really bad pendulum swing. Number two is a lot of these movements are guesses in the first place. And so they're thinking to themselves, why do I have to be a first mover on this guess? Why can't I let my competitors take the plunge first and I'll figure it out later? And number three is, at our core, as humans, we just want to survive. And so whether you're a CEO or a team lead, you are thinking about, how do I keep my job? And if you believe that the biggest threat is handling AI wrong, you are going to be hesitant. You are going to be, you know, non-declarative about big, scary things because you're saving yourself in the process. And so a lot of the work that I do with C-suite is those deep one-on-one conversations. It ends up sounding a little bit like therapy. I mean, I'm sure you have the same thing with customers too. But so much of it is getting them to a place where they feel safe to make risky moves and to find ways of mitigating risk with AI agents, right? Starting small, that's always going to be a risk mitigator. Starting internal only, that's always going to be a risk mitigator. Not having it all on you, right? Who's your bigger AI task force? Who can you actually pull in? Maybe you're a non-technical leader. Great, pull in your CDO, CIO, CTO as your co-lead for this new AI task force. There's so many ways to mitigate risk because CEOs are moving to this space and it's so new, they don't know how to navigate. And so I end up being, you know, 30% therapist, but also like 30% captain with them and just being like, here's where you steer the ship. Let's freaking go. And then they find that path and then they can still, you know, bring their own brilliance to the table.
So a lot of leaders, a lot of companies think, okay, the metrics that we should focus on are automation and cost cutting. Is that not correct? Why? Okay.
it's part of it. But no, that's like an acid reflux reaction.
Okay.
Cost cutting is always going to be part of any sort of transformation move. But again, it is a trap if you are only measuring it by that. In the same way, by the way, that when Facebook was only thinking about likes, that means that they're, what are they only going to put on there? Oh, I got married. Oh, I got a new job. Oh, I got this. And then all of a sudden your newsfeed is just like only big milestones and you lose these mini moments, right? Or you optimize for views. Well, guess what? Then we get extreme like anger, rage bait sort of posts. What you optimize for ends up having massive downstream impact. If you are only optimizing all of your AI work by cost cutting, I almost guarantee you, you will miss out on the deep-seated people-related problems. That's one. And you will miss out on those big, potentially profitable opportunities that your business is going to miss because you're so focused on these tiny, tiny moves. That's number one. Number two, which it actually sounds like you're really strong at in this way, and so I'm hoping that you share this on other podcasts. If you are thinking about little bitty efficiency and productivity things, if you are only thinking about like writing emails faster or writing SQL queries faster, you still write the email and you still write the SQL query. Maybe there's a world in which you shouldn't be writing that email in the first place. You shouldn't be writing that SQL query in the first place. If you are just making horses move faster, you're going to miss cars. And so a lot of having this AI first mindset, which we talk about a lot and which we teach and everything, so much of that AI first mindset is the willingness and open-mindedness to say, maybe this process sucks. Maybe this process is wrong. Maybe we shouldn't be writing emails. Maybe we shouldn't be all in a meeting. Maybe we shouldn't have 500 invoices on our table, whatever. And stepping back and going, whoa, 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 whoa. The actual reason we're doing this task in the first place is maybe you're like, give me an example. You're right, SQL query, you're trying to grab something. What might be one accomplishment, like one data visualization that you're trying to build?
For SQL queries in particular?
Sure. Imagine you're trying to write a Python script, sort of like a line of code. The actual thing that you're building, like what is one workflow that you recently built?
Okay, so a route in order to actually automate a SQL query. Like,
this is just meta.
Dude, I've just been writing it. That's the problem.
Okay, this
is
what I love this.
Okay.
I love this. Because you asked yourself, should I be the person writing the SQL query every single time?
No, I didn't want to.
Exactly. You were willing to rethink your role in this process. And by reminding yourself that you are someone who is meant to govern databases and not as someone who is meant to write the SQL query, that meant that you were able to remove yourself from the process, take one step back and say, I am willing to make this tool and to make this workflow that does it for me because I don't define myself by that task. You don't define yourself by the person that writes SQL. You define yourself by the person who takes that SQL query's output and does something freaking smart with it. So much of that rethinking is not going to happen if you are just thinking about little mini cost cutting. Maybe if you think about bigger cost cutting, you'll eventually get there, but it's a trap. It's a total trap. You have to think about it a little bit, right? Because we don't want to waste money on these tools. We want to find efficiency. That's a big part of this. But it is a trap.
So that's more on the micro level, right? Saying that I don't want to write SQL queries. And I'll call myself the governor of data. What did you say?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Well, I'm the governor of databases.
Yeah, mayor of data. Sure.
Okay.
But give yourself a promotion.
But on the macro level, that is just one individual thing that I can do. What is the first step that a C-suite can look at and be like, okay, this is the first step I'm going to take to start using AI agents?
So there's like 500 things in between, right? And almost never is a C-suite going to say, here's how we're using AI agents.
Never?
Almost never.
Okay.
Maybe they build something like at home and they're like pretty psyched about it and they come back and show it.
Seriously? Like you're telling me C-suite, like, hey, listen, I've actually messed around with Crew AI.
Oh,
it's
there's
sick.
A lot of different C-suite leaders. There are some that are like, I built my own PC 50 years ago and I can't wait to like hack on ChatGPT. There's that. And then there's get me out of here, right? There's another category of like, I've been through so much. I have survived so much. Just get me through this next movement. And both of those can be brilliant AI leaders. The actual question that you asked was, how should C-suite kind of think about how AI agents can be used internally? The thing that a CEO in particular is going to do is set the vision for an org, right? They're going to figure out who that task force is that they want to bring in. And they're going to say, when it comes to thinking about AI, our pillars of AI are going to be, I'm making this up, but like efficiency might be one, customer satisfaction might be another, and reinvention might be another. Right? They get to decide these visionary pillars that then get distributed to the whole company. So they're picking that task force and leadership. They're picking the vision pillars. I think the third thing that they should do is give resources and capability and budget and then get the heck out of people's way. A big way that they can do this is to allocate resources, cough, cough, budget, cough, cough, right? Money to spin up something like a frontier unit. And so that maybe in old school terms would have been like a diamond team, right? But it is a group that might be 50 people, 20 people, 6 people, depending on how big your company is. And that is going to be this like secret little circle of people that is not just engineers, by the way, right? It is a well-rounded group of AI positive, AI first individuals that cannot wait to figure out what this thing can do. The reason I didn't say that they're an R&D group is because this group should also be thinking about business outcomes in a way that R&D might not. R&D is going to be thinking about cool research and maybe this is an interesting way of using AI agents, but they're not tied to business outcomes. That frontier unit should still be driven there. Those are some things that a CEO must do. Visionary pillars, team leadership, and a zone of budget and resources to actually get stuff done.
What you're talking about is having people who are passionate, but also having them governed a little bit by like somebody's like, okay, we know this is cool, but we want to see the business outcome. So having like that small group of people, I think that would be so much fun to work on.
It's everything being goal-based and first principles-based. I think like that's helpful for really anything, not just AI and AI agents. So if you can say goal-based, the goal of this group is to test 5 new tools every month. The goal is to make $5 million more dollars a month. The goal is to figure out how to fire 5,000 people, right? Some of these goals are good, some are icky, but you as the CEO get to determine what that goal is. You as the CEO plus that task force get to determine the goal. And then those vision pillars that I was talking about, that's the first principles thinking. Then you get out of people's way. And you can review and approve and check in, you know, biweekly to start and then eventually monthly on what this group is actually outputting and whether they are going to be successful. That is at a C-suite level. a lot of companies are starting to ask me, like, should we do that hackathon you just did? And I'm like, yes. So that is, you know, not necessarily at the C-suite level, depending on how big the company is. If it's 40,000 people, it's definitely not C-suite level. But you should be thinking about, how do we enable people to run a little hackathon at scale? I gave everyone on my team, I said, for 2 weeks, you have to test at minimum 2 AI agents. I'll give you a budget of $100 because most of these platforms are like 20, 40 bucks a month or something. And in 2 weeks, we are going to have an hour and a half meeting where every single person is going to screen share what they learned, what they built, what they saw, what worked well, what didn't. And I want you to come so opinionated that you offend me. I want you to come so strong, so heavy hitting that we are fighting on this call. And so hour and a half goes by and at the end we go, oh, amazing. We know where AI agents are today. You can do that at a much bigger scale inside of a company. And people were doing this beginning of 2023 and middle of 2023 with standard, you know, AI, generative AI use cases. We're just now at the next like evolution, next chapter of that.
When are companies supposed to start thinking about governance and security?
20,000 years ago. I think a lot of companies leave it to the last second. Definitely think about it early. Definitely about bringing in the legal and HR perspectives early, not being afraid to have them in there as detractors, having those conversations up front. That is absolutely one of those pieces. The second, which is a little bit harder to think through as a C-suite, is that the space is constantly changing. I cracked the joke about, you know, things might change 5 minutes after we record this podcast. That actually might be the case. And so setting yourself up for more adaptable processes, that is a very hard thing to think about. But I always find that by talking about business 20 years in the future, it's easier to, you know, plan today. When I talk about what comes after the AI age, it's the evolution age. This idea that everything is moving and shaping in real time. When AI becomes your business operating system, you are able to become much more adaptable. At its core, it is about adaptability. It is about building these processes in place so that the operating system of your business is actually supported by both humans and AI.
We hear a lot about this skills gap in AI. Can you explain what that is?
There's two massive skill gaps. One is that employees today don't understand how to use AI systems today. And so that's things like training people how to use, maybe it's AI agents, maybe it's ChatGPT, Claude, Copilot, whatever. The second skills gap is thinking about the mindset shift, right? So there's kind of like the tool side and the people side. What those two are going to enable you to do is be able to upskill your company so that if maybe new jobs come online, right? Jobs that we could have never predicted, like podcast host.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there were always radio hosts, but like, you know, were there podcast hosts 30 years ago? Not really. So as we're thinking about new jobs that could come online, by having people know how to use the tools and have that AI first mindset, you're going to be in a much better place when those come online.
Well, how do you get people to have an AI first mindset?
The most important thing to do is actually show them a couple examples of this tool, kind of like light their brains up a little bit, and then immediately get out of the tool, right? If you bury yourself in, here's exactly how to prompt, you will never get to this AI first mindset because it's a behavior change. Someone that I follow, Connor Grennan in the space, always talks about if everything was just down to teaching people how to use a tool, we would all be teaching people, hey, here's how you lose weight, here's a treadmill, and we would all be fantastically in shape. That's not how behavior change works. So a lot of having that AI first mindset comes down to building up the culture and habits inside of your company to actually have that. The second piece to having that AI first mindset is giving space for experimentation. I've now used these generative AI systems for thousands of hours. And so AI first mindset, it is about that experimentation. It's about behavior, it's about habits. And then the last thing to call out on AI first mindset, this is a trickier one, having that goal-based view. So the goal of, let's say, a SQL query or checking the CRM of your company to pull something out or, you know, reviewing a 10K from a company. You have a certain goal. So maybe if you're reviewing a 10K, it's eventually to write a deal memo internally at your company about whether your company should include that firm in your new bond portfolio or something. So new investment portfolio. As you are reviewing that 10K, the output in your mind is, oh, I have to make that memo. So many people use AI to just review the 10K or to find the 10K when you should be using it to find the 10K, to poke questions at the 10K, to ask what it's missing, to ask lesser known things and less obvious things that it could be picking up on, show it five other example 10Ks and compare them against them so that that deal memo that maybe you also talk back and forth with AI to write or talk back and forth with AI to review, that deal memo, the outcome was actually better off in the first place. So a lot of the education that I end up putting out there is like, talk about the thing you actually wanted to pull off. You Googling something like, what is the character's name in this specific movie? You Googling that is because you wanted to get that answer to then write a social post about it. Just ask AI to help you with the social posts. You can kind of remove some of these little miniature steps in between and have that more strategic view to how you're actually using AI systems.
Can you give us an example of a team that used agentic AI to actually build something creatively or strategically or high quality, not just quicker, not just more efficient, but something that's like was really impactful?
You know, there's a good example with Audi. Audi was using AI to kind of co-design their wheels with human and AI together. Reason I love this, number one, they kept human in the loop because those designs still really needed to be reviewed by a human. The second very cool thing that they did in this use case was that they had actually two AI systems kind of fighting with each other. Okay, so have you heard of like a GAN, a generative adversarial network?
Nope.
Okay, so a GAN, this is like kind of pre-ChatGPT, some people still use them. It's this idea that you have a generator and a discriminator. One AI is making stuff and just spewing out noise into the world. And then the second one, the discriminator is like, that works, that doesn't, that works, that doesn't, right? So you have like the creative mind and then you have like the professor judging. Audi did the exact same thing where they have like one AI model that is cranking out wackadoo wheel design ideas. And then they have a second AI going, that is a square and will never work as a wheel. We should not do that, okay? And then they scrap it. And so only when the discriminator has said, ooh, I like this one, does it then pass off to a human who then has another AI system that they're going back and forth with to say, can you make it bigger? Can you make it smaller? Can you make it, you know, spew lasers out of it? Whatever. And all of that was kind of multiple AIs plus human working in concert. I love that one. The second piece, there is a use case where you can cut time from task A in order to be more creative in task B. There's a world in which it really removes the drudgery that then lets you take on some interesting creative tasks as well.
So what is one piece of advice that you swear by for someone in the tech leadership space right now?
A big thing that I talk about is the pace of change. You know, maybe the first meeting that I have with C-suite is just convincing them that everything's going to be okay and that we're going to get through it together. And also hearing, you know, where they are on their AI journey, just normal call. The second call is talking about the pace of change and making sure that they have seen the numbers that I have seen. So one example, GPT 3.5, right, which came out with ChatGPT, so November 2022, came out. It was in the 10th percentile on the bar exam. GPT-4 came out 5 months later, scored 90% on the bar exam. GPQA, the Google Proof like PhD questions benchmark, we were at a random guessing level in December 2023, and then we were exceeding PhD level December 2024. You see these changes happening as an AI, you know, expert in this field. You get hit with acid reflux, and then you realize, okay, there's no way I can keep up with this pace of change completely with the processes that I have in place today. And so it's really taking a step back and saying, actually, the most important thing to prioritize for you as a CEO, for you governing and managing and steering the ship to this whole thing, is keeping in mind not only the pace of change that we've already seen up until this date, but is also knowing that the pace of change is going to continue to increase and that you as a people leader, as a tech leader, as a financial leader, as someone that is bringing together, you know, shareholders as well and customers, you have to be prioritizing the pace of change. Pay attention to the pace of change. Don't be afraid of it. Lean in and actually use it as a strength.
The pace of change is scary, though.
For you or for people you talk to? Or
for everyone.
Yeah. We're not evolved to deal with this pace of change, right? Like even social media feeds. Yeah. Our brains are not really made to like scroll through and see a horrific explosion and then 2 seconds later see a baby being born. And then 2 seconds later we see a dog screaming like, and it sounds like a goat. Like our brains aren't, those are great videos, but our brains are not built for that. And so we're already seeing what happens when we're at like pace of change capacity. I think a lot of people, they're getting more into the like, how do I take control back? I talked to a lot of tech leaders. You know what the most popular thing that they are doing right now? They're going to silent retreats. That is the thing that I hear like all of these tech execs talking about. They are fleeing into the forest for a week or two to just sit in silence. I still think that even with the pace of change, we're actually going to see an increase in like in real life, meditative, personal sort of experiences that we haven't really had to come to terms with over the last 10 years. It's almost like because we're crazy over capacity that now we get to rethink it. When it was like at 95%, people told themselves like, no, I can handle it. And now that it's at like 250%, people are going, okay, now I should probably care about my health.
It's everything though, right? Like, especially yeah. in the tech world, like this is constant for me. I'm constantly learning new frameworks. And for someone like me, I had to sit there and I had to be like, I have to learn this. And it's not just because luckily I find it very interesting and it's a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
But it's also like, if I don't learn this tool, if I'm not on the bleeding edge always, that someone's going to replace me.
Why do you have that feeling?
Because it's true. Is it? Yes. I think in order to be an expert in my field, you have to constantly be on the bleeding edge, always. It's just the way it is. I mean, it's engineers, like you have like the anomalous people who are like COBOL developers, who know a coding language from like, the 60s. They're the ones who, that's been static. We still use mainframes, but for the most part, if you don't have a baseline understanding of this new tech as it's coming out, you're going to be left in the dust for sure. You don't think so?
I do. I think what's interesting is that there are some roles, some tools where adaptability doesn't have to happen at such a small time scale. This is one thing, like I do think that the pace of change is important, but do I think that like a CEO needs to update their vision every single day? No. It's the same thing with investment portfolios, right? Stocks are crazy changing, but if you hold on, every decade for the last whatever 80 years has seen an overall stock increase. There is something to be said about understanding the pace of change, paying attention to the pace of change, but not re-steering the ship on too small of a time quantity. It is up to the CEO and their leadership group and partners or advisors that they bring on onto their board to say, what is actually the right time change frequency that we should be looking at? You're gonna have some CEOs pick too long of a time and say, we should only update our strategy every 2 years. That's clearly wrong. And you're gonna have some CEOs freak out every single 10 hours as they see a new Sam Altman tweet and also change the course. It's something in the middle, right? But it's adaptability at the right cadence that I think is really important for leaders.
What about for like engineers?
Again, every single role is going to be different. For engineers, it's not a daily shift. You can probably be reading things every 2 to 3 weeks and be fine. Even that, you don't even have to be a first adopter of these frameworks. And you can wait and let some bugs get out before you come into V2.
I do like it, but there is always that. I guess it's just an undercurrent, maybe just because of the pace of change that you're talking about, that they're seeing that there is this undercurrent amongst the engineer class. They're being like, we have to constantly be on the bleeding edge.
Yeah.
They just believe it.
It's also, I do think it depends. You know, I talk to a lot of different types of companies. There are some companies that pride themselves on being first movers, annual revenues over $50 billion that are constantly pushing these frontiers. If you are at that company, in order to succeed and to be a culture match, yes, you would need to look at that rate of adaptation. If you are at a mid-market enterprise, if you are at a slower moving company and you are loving that pace of change, maybe you move companies because at that company, that pace of change might not be as applauded or appreciated. And so I guess it's like it's adaptability at the right pace of change and in the right environment. There's something to the context and environment of it that I think probably makes it so that you actually like staying up to date on all these new frameworks.
I do.
Even if in 5 months it goes nowhere.
Before we end, I want to ask, is there anything that we should be talking about AI agents that we haven't discussed today?
There is a stat from McKinsey that I really think is important here, which is that the ratio of dollars spent on tech versus people, that a lot of companies have it at a 5-to-1 when it should be a 1-to-5. So for every $1 spent on tech, you should be spending $5 on people. And that people might be upskilling, might be constant education quizzes and getting that out there, might be sending people to conferences. It could be a lot of different things, but I think a lot of leaders are getting the ratio of people and tech wrong, and that they're probably, again, they're moving too fast, they're going to be breaking things along the way. And that break is good sometimes, but if it loses your culture and trust, you will not have a company that is going to succeed in 10 years. And so you have to be prioritizing that culture and trust. That does not mean that you can't have layoffs. That does not mean that you might not have a revenue dip. That does not mean that you have to, you know, hug everyone and give everyone promotion once they learn an AI tool. There are a lot of kumbaya moments that some companies might employ and some might not, but you have to at least prioritize those people and treat them with dignity and treat them with respect as you're going through this process.
Allie, genuinely, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
To those of you at home, click the link below to get started with your agentic AI journey and make sure to stay tuned to AI in Action on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to stay up to date on the most cutting-edge conversations in the industry. See you soon.